This podcast contains explicit content and is not suitable for all ages. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to Always the Last to Know. I'm Ash.
I'm Katie.
What's going on, Katie?
I just had like one of those weird, you know, like when the bubble comes in your mouth and like it makes your voice feel weird.
Yeah.
I just had one of those.
I could see that.
It's been a week for me. I will get into that at some point. I may have news up and coming.
Mm. You do.
So we shall see, but I don't want to talk about it yet because I don't want to jinx myself.
Yes. Knock on wood.
Yeah, but things are going good. Going up to Jersey for a sleepover with Ashley and our friend Michelle soon, which I'm super excited about.
Yes! Oh, I can't wait.
I know, it's going to be so much fun. Moving
along. Michelle has 3 Australian Shepherds at her house, and it is chaos, and I love it.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
It's amazing.
Yeah, so that's what's going on with me. What about you?
You know what's so funny? Maybe like an hour ago, before I went on my walk to get out my pre-recording energy, I was like, Chalupa, please, your snorts are so loud today. Calm down. I just gave him a gourmet treat from a place in Somerville. Thank you, Megan. Before we were recording a while ago, I was like, do I have any updates? Do I? And then I was like, oh, I actually fucking do, and it's a big one.
A huge one, dude.
A huge one. I have decided to run for council in my town again.
Hell yeah.
As some of you know, if you have gotten caught up on the podcast, I ran for council in my town last year. Unfortunately, I didn't win, but sometimes that's just how the cookie crumbles. And we have to put in our petitions for our nominations by March 27th. There are 2 seats up again in town and a mayoral seat. I do not want Ooh. That fucking job, though. No, thank you.
No.
So I'm still looking for a running mate. Hopefully I find a really good one. We've got a couple people that we are choosing from. We got someone who I think would be incredible. If you're listening, you know who you are for mayor. But I don't want to announce that yet. But I'm like super excited to do this again. I was very, very nervous at the beginning of last year's whole process. But now that I know what goes into this, I am like actually really excited for this.
Definitely. It's not an unknown anymore. Yes. So you know what to expect, mm-hmm. which is perfect.
And there's definitely been some like interesting tea that we have been hearing about some of our opponents. And I don't know. I think this is going to be an interesting, interesting election this year. And I cannot wait for this process to start.
Oh, I bet. I'm excited for the up and coming election season. It's gonna be really cool to see what happens.
We were talking about some tea that I got this morning, which I cannot announce on here.
Should I even be talking about this?
But not that, but just being in this whole political sphere, I get a lot of information that is not totally public right away. And this morning Katie was like, I feel like we're in Scandal.
I really did.
And I was like, shit, yeah.
This Washington tea.
This is very exciting.
It really is. Mm. It's so cool. I'm so excited to watch you become a political dynasty.
Better than JFK.
Hell yeah. Which really wouldn't be that hard.
Yeah.
Now that we know everything we know about him.
To be honest. But yeah, so that's my fun little update.
All right, should we just get on into it? Actually just jump right in? Yeah. So yeah, wow, we're actually just going to jump right into it. I think that's the first time that's happened.
I don't know.
I mean, like, listen, unplanned.
Okay, unplanned, yeah. I was going to say, because that 2.5 hour long...
That one we really just went for it, yeah. I started my research and notes for the American prison system episode that I had mentioned, before our crossover. And then I was like, damn, I really need some more time. So what do I talk about this week? And then I kind of sat and thought, what is more culturally significant? The Renaissance or the disaster known as Fyre Festival? And to be honest, I really didn't know a lot about Fyre Fest other than the fact that it was a disaster.
Yeah.
So I thought, hey, I love disasters. Let's look into this.
Let's dive into this beautiful disaster.
Let's dive into this. And I saw a lot of things online that called it a dumpster fire, spelled F-Y-R-E, and just like chef's kiss on that. That's incredible. A lot of my information is coming from Hulu's documentary about the festival, which does include involvement from the creator and founder of the festival, Billy McFarland, in the form of interviews. I also got information from the Netflix documentary. But while I was digging into everything, there's something really interesting about the Netflix documentary that we have to note. The social media company that was hired by Fyre, the company, to promote their festival was Jerry Productions, of the Fuck Jerry meme Instagram account I think everyone's pretty familiar with.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. And they have, at this current point, 16.8 million followers.
Wow.
They're also the creators of that game, What Do You Meme? Which I've definitely seen in Target.
Okay, yes, yes, I've definitely seen that.
And I didn't know that they made that, but they did, so I just wanted to include that. The account of the Fyre Festival was given to a recent hire within the company named Oren Aks, A-K-S, who undoubtedly did an amazing job with the social media campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was legendary, and, you know, he had nothing to do with the disaster part, so he is still pretty proud of the work that he, the design and social media work that he did for Fyre.
I mean,
Festival.
It was everywhere. Everyone wanted to go.
And he should be. He's in the Hulu documentary, not in the Netflix one.
Okay.
Which is important to note, considering that when things went awry with the festival, the legal documentation that came out of Jerry Media had this to say. Quote, per our previous correspondence, Oren Aks has misrepresented himself, unquote. To which Oren, in the Hulu documentary, hears for the first time and says, okay, well, fuck you guys. Where they then splash text across the screen saying that after 6 months after the Fyre Festival, he ended up quitting Jerry Media to start his own social media strategy agency. Mm-hmm. Jerry Media and Vice produced the Netflix documentary.
Oh, wow.
Which really puts everything they had to say into perspective, because they definitely had blame in this situation to shift. Because of that discovery, I had to rewatch the entire Netflix documentary to see what information I got from that, so then I could see how it compared to not just the Hulu one, but other written sources as well, to ensure the information we are getting is as unbiased and truthful as possible.
Can we talk about how that was this morning?
Yeah. That was 11:30 a.m. today, when I FaceTimed Ashley in the middle of her errands and was like, literally everything about my notes has just fucking changed. Hold up.
I was like, just give me a minute. And then I called you back while I was waiting to drop off donations at the food bank. And I'm like, cool, I'm just waiting here. Give me the tea.
Yeah, what's up? Fucked me up. It really fucked
me up.
What
did I say? I said, fuck me up, fam.
Yeah. And the people who were involved in Jerry Media, who not only produced the Netflix documentary, were also included as a few talking heads from the company in the documentary, including Mick Pierzycki, the CEO, and James Ryan Oliger, the co-founder of the company and one of the main producers of the movie. Here are some quotes that I pulled from journalist Joe Livingston that kind of highlights some of the issues that I felt I needed to point out before getting into all of this. Quote, the Hulu documentary was originally supposed to be a series, but was rushed into early release in feature-length form to beat the Netflix film to the punch. Then there were accusations from the Netflix camp that Hulu had behaved unethically by paying Billy McFarland, the founder guy, to appear in its documentary. So they're like kind of throwing shade at each other.
God. Not the streaming services.
Right? This is another quote. Hulu's fire fraud focus on social media marketing agency Fuck Jerry, which is trying to rebrand as Jerry Media, and its complicity in McFarlane's doomed project. But Netflix's fire was mysteriously quiet on that issue. Instead, highlighting eye-poppingly nefarious anecdotes like the event producer Andy King's claim that he came very close to performing fellatio on a customs official to extract a detained shipment of Evian water.
What?
That was a claim that they made in the documentary, which is like truly, I feel like it was just like over-scandalized for the point of like putting scandalous stuff on there.
It's like, how absolutely unhinged can I be just to make this watchable?
This is another quote. But whoever was in the room when the final cut was made, Fuck Jerry was still heavily involved. Persia C had pivoted the old tainted brand to video, dressing it up in the credibility of names like Netflix and Vice. These companies have been used, in effect, as the washing machine through which Fuck Jerry laundered its involvement in this catastrophe, end quote.
I mean, that's exactly what they did. In dramatic terms, but that's exactly what they did.
If you're gonna go watch the documentaries, highly suggest Hulu. If you have already watched Netflix's, take everything that you learned there with
a grain of salt.
Yeah, well, not even necessarily with a grain of salt, because a lot of it includes like footage that they kind of owned the rights to, and we'll get into that. Mm-hmm. But with the understanding of like they're very heavily shifting focus on one part and not super owning up the part that they played in it. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the Hulu documentary, Oren is very self-reflective.
Yeah.
And he doesn't take like fault, but he is like, in hindsight, I really should have stopped and kind of like looked at what was going on.
Yeah.
This was really fucked up. So let's get into it. Firefest was supposed to be a musical festival that exceeded all expectations with live music on a private island owned by Pablo Escobar in the Bahamas.
I'm sorry. Owned by Pablo Escobar?
Well, let's actually stop right there, because neither the island they had Firefest on, nor the island they filmed the promotional video on, were ever owned by Pablo Escobar personally.
Oh, how would they even get away with saying that? No one questioned it.
It comes up later, but not because they're questioning whether or not Pablo Escobar was involved, but as to how this was an issue with the person who actually owned the island.
Okay.
Attendees spent tens of thousands of dollars for this high-end and exclusive experience, which was supposed to be the new Coachella meets Burning Man meets Instagram come to life. It was labeled as an immersive experience bordering on the impossible, which it kind of was impossible because it didn't fucking happen.
Yeah.
However, the more I learned about Firefest, the more I realized it wasn't just a story about a music festival, but also the story of a lifelong scam artist. So before we can even talk about the festival, we have to look at its founder and creator, Billy McFarland.
Why do I know that name?
Probably because he was so heavily talked about for a really long time that it's in the back of your subconscious. Or he did grow up in New Jersey.
Oh,
I don't know where in New Jersey.
We all know each other.
Yeah, everyone in Jersey knows everyone. And he was straight up a rich capitalist from the beginning. I say this because in a letter from his mom sent to the courts, she talks about how he was swimming in the ocean at a young age, and the picture included is a picture of him as like a really young child in front of their personal fucking boat. And then she talks about how he was like scubaing at 10. Ugh. And again, like that is a rich person's gig. I think even in Outer Banks, there was one part where they like needed to scuba. And they're like, I don't know how to scuba. Like, that's a kook thing. Like, it's for rich people. Scuba gear is expensive.
It is.
Billy talked about the first time that he, quote, made a business in first grade, which is when he offered a girl sitting next to him to fix her broken crayon for $1. And he turned that into like a little business.
Wow. In the Even first as grade. A kid, he couldn't just help someone out of the kindness of his heart.
A capitalist from the fucking beginning. Born the same year as we were, Billy grew up with the internet, but in a very different way.
Do we know what town he is from? I need to know.
Milburn.
That's like really close to where I grew up.
The West Sheffield Short Hills section of Milburn.
Oh, well, which absolutely makes sense because Short Hills, Milburn, like, it's a richy rich area.
Yeah, it is.
It really is.
Yeah, it is.
When I go to the Short Hills Mall, it's to go window shopping.
Yeah.
Or I used to deliver food from Muscle Maker Grill to the Lacoste guys all the time at the Short Hills Mall.
That's incredible. Billy grew up with the internet, but in a very different way than we did, because Billy said in the fifth grade he had a web hosting company with 3 employees in India.
Shut the fuck up. What?
Whether that's true or not, he's like trying to project that idea anyway, and it pretty much says the same gross shit about him. Regardless. As he got older, Billy tried to introduce some sort of internet social media gig. It was called Spling. But it didn't go anywhere, and I honestly didn't care enough to look into it anymore. So I didn't. His next idea was just as unoriginal. Billy ordered a thin sheet of metal and copied his debit card information onto it with a magnetic strip, basically making a, quote, cool, sleek, high-end debit card.
Jesus.
It was essentially the black card, but metal.
Yeah.
And thus, his company Magnesis was born. It's 2013, and people are referring to the Magnesis card as the Millennial Black Card.
I have never heard of this.
Interesting, because it was in New York City. All it really does, though, is like piggyback off of your regular card with extra perks. It's not connected to a bank in any way. So it's not a credit card. It's just a membership card to the Magnesis Club that's on your debit card.
I see no point in being a member. There's no value.
The big thing that was offered was a membership that came with a little club townhouse in New York City. It's kind of like all those fancy social clubs that you see in every New York City-based TV show. If you're thinking to yourself, I genuinely do not understand why the fuck anyone would want this, please know that at first, I didn't either, and I needed to pause both documentaries to try and figure out what the fuck this was. According to every source I've read, quote, we all know that the Amex Black Card is invite-only offered by American Express for members hitting certain spending limits, thought to be around $250,000 annually, end quote. No, I did not know that. And you and I had a conversation about that last night where I was just like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
That
I didn't know you had to be invited to this credit card. And
wow.
Wow, imagine being that rich.
I literally could never.
I can't conceive imagine it.
That. That's insane. Someone in the Hulu documentary said that the Magnesis club and like business was sort of like Entertainment 720 from Parks and Rec, where it's like not actual business, but like guys in business.
That, you know what? Now I understand. Now
okay,
I understand.
Okay.
You just put it into terms. I was a little lost about what the fuck was going on, but now I get
mm-hmm.
it.
Okay, perfect. So every year, a Magnesis member would pay $250 in a membership fee and gain access to this townhouse and, quote, other perks. The Magnesis card claimed that it would offer discounts to certain events, dinners, or stores, pretty similarly to how Amex offers. Magnesis also set up their own concierge service that would supposedly help members get tickets to these events, but the service was horrible.
Oh. Oh boy.
That source continued to go on and just talk about how amazing American Express was. So part of me thinks that that source may have just been one long advertisement for black cards. Because it was just like, although the service lacked in comparison to what American Express has to offer. And I was like, okay, wait, you have now talked about how great American Express is like 5 or 6 times.
Someone at American Express really wanted that rating.
Yes. Definitely. Definitely. So there are times where tickets to huge events are sold out, but some will already be pre-set aside for Amex Platinum and Black Card holders. McFarland and Magnesis tried to offer the same thing. Where did any of this money come to do all of this come from, you ask? I also asked. The money came from a man named Aubrey McClendon, who was the CEO of Chesapeake Energy, one of the country's most powerful independent gas producers. Mm. He was the owner of the Oklahoma City Thunder and heir to one of the wealthiest families in America. All around, just a rich motherfucker. After seeing this like shiny new metal card that makes nice noise when put on table, Aubrey McClendon drops $500,000. That's the only difference. Like shiny, make noise.
Oh no.
He drops $500,000 in investment in Magnesis, whatever that is, a vibe. Billy's next step was to take that cash to influencers and celebrities to create press stories that would come out and build a huge buzz around him and his card. This is when he meets Ja Rule.
Okay.
And that relationship doesn't really come to anything for a little bit, but I just needed to throw that in
there.
All
right, all right.
Because timeline-wise.
Yes. We love a complete story. Thank you for that.
Yeah, of course. However, the owner of the townhouse opens up a lawsuit for the cost of damages for the townhouse that Magnesis was renting for $100,000. These damages were caused by parties thrown in the townhouse and violations caused by McFarland for using the residence as a headquarters to conduct business out of.
Oh, shit.
This was a residential apartment, and he made it a townhouse business club. And had fucking trashed it. So they got kicked out of their townhouse. And that was really the biggest selling point of the card. Mm-hmm. So Billy started coming up with different scams to attract people to get this card, saying that they had tickets to Beyonce shows, Hamilton shows, but what it really was a giant Ponzi scheme. Billy would say, "We're selling Beyonce tickets," and then get a bunch of money from the Magnesis card holders to then buy the tickets for insane prices on StubHub on a credit card, and then run another ticket selling scheme to pay off the last one.
Oh my God.
Things were going downhill very fast. People are complaining left and right. They're not joining Magnesis the way that Billy needs to in order to keep this going. Then, Billy's most important investor, Aubrey McClendon, is indicted for fraud.
While committing fraud.
While committing fraud. While investing in someone else who's committing fraud. Yes. Fraud so intense that he's being labeled the next Enron.
Shit.
Wow. And then McClendon, the next day, dies in a fiery car crash.
What?
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Unrelated to any of Billy, but just, he just dies in a fiery car crash.
Jesus.
But don't worry. Billy, like the little capitalist motherfucker that he is, finds his way out of this dilemma. Mm. Billy meets Corolla Jane. Can you imagine? Corolla Jane, wife of Bob Jane, who runs one of the biggest hedge funds in New York City. And she just becomes like a hardcore investor in just like Billy.
Wow.
She digs his Magnesis. She digs his ideas. And rumors at Magnesis start going around that a few other people are working on a side business. This is when Billy flies down to the Bahamas and lands on an island known as Norman's Key, where he meets a bartender, Delroy Jackson. Billy himself, in the Hulu documentary, says, quote, "Our pitch was simple. We want to bring music to this island and allow hundreds of people to come and experience the magic at one time. And we're hoping to build a creative center in the Bahamas, where maybe our music artists would come here and record, models can come out and shoot, and we're hoping to have a year-round creative center that was culminated in this annual festival. Delroy said that there is no fucking way that that could happen. At some point between that conversation and October 2016, just months before Fyre Festival, Ja Rule and Billy meet with ad agencies, specifically Jerry Media of Fuck Jerry Instagram, to try and make a new idea somewhat related to their last one happen. November of 2016, 5 months before the festival is set, Billy and Ja Rule are at the Web Summit, where we get the first real big piece of press involved in talking about the festival. They talk about how the two of them met, which was when Billy was attempting to hire Ja Rule for a private event at the Magnesis Clubhouse that no longer exists. In this Web Summit, Ja Rule makes the unfortunate choice of referring to Billy as his, quote, partner in crime, end quote.
Yikes. What a turn.
Foreshadowing. The two of them are here to talk about the Fyre app, which was supposed to be the Uber of booking music and talent for private parties. A real rich person thing. Mm-hmm. And here's where they also announce Fyre Fest, which is supposed to be the music festival promoting the launch of the app.
Oh.
The next step was marketing this crazy venture that they had planned. So they fly down to the Bahamas again and film a commercial.
So they are filming a commercial for a festival where they're not allowed to actually have the festival.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes. Okay.
For a festival that they want to have in 6 months with no infrastructure or anything created for it.
Wow.
But they're filming a commercial.
Worst business model ever.
Truly. So they hired some of the biggest models of all time, where Netflix lists off, quote, Kendall Jenner, Bella Hadid, and Hailey Baldwin, now Bieber. Full stop? I didn't know that she was a model.
The only thing I know about her is that she is Justin Bieber's wife.
Okay, okay. So maybe she is a model or not.
I guess. Maybe? She seems to be famous.
Do they just mean like Instagram model? I don't know. Anyway, it doesn't super matter. But I was just like, oh shit, of course she's involved in this. So the production shoot for this commercial was more of a party on film rather than a professional shoot. Imagine if the worst parts of Instagram became sentient for a weekend. That was basically the private filming shoot that they did. During all of this, they told everyone there that they had bought the island. They hadn't.
Wow. Yeah. That's a big ass lie.
It's an island size lie. They also did this charming little toast. Quote, here's to living like movie stars, partying like rock stars, and fucking like porn stars. End quote. Was Ja Rule and Billy's little toast that they gave to kind of paint a picture of the environment that these women had been hired to hang out in for a weekend.
Do you know what that sounds like? A place I never want to go because I do not think I would feel safe.
Yeah. It's horrible. You can see some of the footage in both documentaries, especially the Netflix one, because it's involved with Jerry Media, who owned a lot of the footage from, like, the raw footage from that shoot, because they were supposed to be marketing it on social media. Mm-hmm. Cringe aside, using these influencers and just having them all together in a beautiful island and posting with the hashtag Fyre Festival created a fucking sensation. All of these women just being together created press about the event, because this is the time of like the girl squad, the mannequin challenge. Like, it's 2016. This is like the highlight of girl squad time, and these gorgeous women are just on this gorgeous beach. At one point they're like swimming with sharks, and another point they're like swimming in like the bluest water you've ever seen with this old plane wreckage under the water. Like, it looks amazing. I remember when this video came out and I was just like, holy shit, I want to go so bad. I wanted to go so fucking bad.
Yeah.
After capturing the entire weekend of gorgeous women partying in the Bahamas, naturally beautiful footage was caught. They launched the Orange Tile campaign, where over 400 of the most famous people on social media all dropped orange tiles on their feeds, linking to the website that contained the edited commercial for Fyre Festival. Kendall Jenner was paid $250,000 to post one long thing about Fyre holding it up.
Christ.
Overnight, a PR storm erupted. Brands wanted to leave Coachella to put all of their money into Fyre. They advertised beautiful sleeping arrangements from glamped out tents to private homes, all the way to a private yacht experience for $250,000. These tickets were not fucking cheap. The tents themselves could be up to $10,000.
What? Okay, this was a party for rich people.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. This was a party for your average wealthy, like your average loser who is like a rich piece of shit who wants to live the like Instagram partying with models life.
Okay.
This wasn't just like your average Joe going to Fyre Festival.
Yeah.
Within 48 hours, 95% of the tickets were sold. That is how fast just social media took this.
Absolutely crazy.
While that was happening, industry insiders are laughing at everything that was promised when Ja Rule spoke at a conference for Music Festival. But Billy and Ja Rule were vouched for, and people continued buying into this idea. There is a reason no one has done this before. Mm-hmm. Of course people would want to do this, but the things that it would take.
More than 6 months of planning.
Right? It takes people like a year to plan a fucking wedding for 100. And we're talking about a party in America in like a rented space, not a fucking private, an international private island. Just ridiculous. There were alarming issues from the start. The most obvious was that with the amount of tickets sold, there was no way to fit all of those people onto the island, let alone house them.
How many tickets were sold?
5,000.
Oh, wow. I'm assuming because was it a small island?
Oh, yeah. Like a dozen people lived on the island that they filmed on.
Oh, shit. Yeah, that's crazy.
The idea of renting a cruise ship to have off-island for people to sleep on was thrown onto the table. But how to get drunk festival goers from island to ship was definitely an issue. Billy insisted that everyone was going to be on the island. Quote, they said it was possible. They said it was possible. End quote.
Who said it was possible, Billy?
No idea.
No one.
No idea. Keith, who was bringing forward all of these logistical issues, from plumbing to beds, was then asked to leave in February/March before the festival, which was supposed to happen the weekend of my birthday, April 30th.
They're like, hey, listen, guy, you're making a little too much sense, and it's putting a real damper on things, so you're fired.
Yeah, but I just want to reiterate, in February/March, the end of February of March, the festival is supposed to be April 28th. They're literally still talking about where people are going to sleep.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah. So they bring down a music festival consultant about 45 days out from the festival. Around that same time, someone is contacted about putting together the cost for everything, which totaled $38
million. $38 million? This man was just losing money on a Ponzi scheme. How is this? What? What?
45 days out, he figured out it was going to cost $38 million. How are you just figuring that out now?
My head hurts.
Right? And they said in the Hulu documentary that the true core team came together to try and make it work like 6 to 8 weeks before the show was supposed to
happen. Try and make $38 million work in 6 to 8 weeks.
$3 to $4 million worth of talent was booked, including Blink-182, Major Lazer, and Good Music, which is like a bunch of rappers, including Kanye, but Kanye was never actually like actually supposed to be there. I didn't really look into that because I didn't care who was supposed to be performing. I just cared how much money they spent on booking the talent. No one performed, so it doesn't matter. Now, Billy and Ja Rule kept telling everyone that they, quote, bought Pablo Escobar's old island, end quote.
Why would you just make that up?
So the island, like, was at one point owned by someone who, like, was adjacent to the cartel, but, like, wasn't anymore. It wasn't Pablo Escobar. But the person who owned it, he wanted to build a new reputation for the island. So it was specifically mentioned in the contracts not to say anything about Pablo Escobar or, like, drug deals or, like, anything like that. And they opened the advertisements with it. The owner saw that and kicked him off the island.
Wow. If I were trying to rebrand, I definitely would not want to be known as the Cartel Island.
Right? So they're forced to find a neighboring island 6 to 8 weeks out and start the entire planning process again, which it honestly kind of seems like they hadn't really started yet anyway. Mm-hmm. But anything that they had figured out landscaping wise, anything, was just ruined because they had to find a new place to go. So they got to Great Exuma, which was another island located near them. It's bigger, it has more structure on there, and it makes sense that we're having it there. The issue was that the festival was planned for the same weekend as the National Regala there, which is a huge event where the island's population doubles. And hotels are booked out for months, sometimes years in advance.
Oh my God.
The locals who were included in the documentaries described it as like the Super Bowl meets Christmas, but bigger.
Wow.
Yeah. So now they're trying to throw this musical festival the same weekend as this. And with hotels and everything already booked, Billy somehow needed to find private homes for the 500 guests who had purchased that specific package.
Oh my God.
On top of that issue, they had also oversold the tent packages with zero infrastructure at the site.
Of course. Of course they did.
The site, right? It gets so much worse. The site itself was essentially a housing development that hadn't been built on, that offered a ton of hazards and really no other benefits other than the fact that it just existed.
Bro, it's not even like on the beach.
You can like see the beach from it, but it's like located on these bluffs that just drop into the water, and they didn't put a fence up. And they're like expecting to have like a huge fucking festival here where people are getting wasted. That's super fucking dangerous.
Yeah, what the fuck?
There was no beach that you could like access and swim at the site.
Oh my God. And you know that's what people would want, especially when you put out a video of hot models swimming in the ocean.
Yeah. Just like, it's so bad. It's so bad. Okay, actually, let me see. I tried to take pictures, but because it's like Hulu.
Hulu doesn't let you take screenshots.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And neither does Netflix.
Yeah, I realized that it blacks it out when you try to take a screenshot.
Which I totally understand. They're like copywriting the stuff.
Yeah. But also like mad annoying when I'm trying to show you guys a specific part in a show.
Exactly. I'm going to text you a picture of the action of the site, including the tents that they brought in.
Oh, okay. So we're talking about like literally a rock wall down into the ocean at a slant with like a flimsy ass metal fence.
Yes.
Cool. Also, these igloo things look, it's like too sterile. This honestly looks like some kind of CDC camp. That's the vibe I'm getting.
Yes. It's funny that you say that because the tents that they ended up getting for their glamped out adventures were actually leftover FEMA tents from Hurricane Matthew.
Shut the fuck up. Are you serious?
Yep.
What a vibe.
Yep.
It's like very medical.
It's so bad. I will have better pictures for the social media that we put out. So look to social media for this. So they oversold the tents. They're having trouble finding private homes. But they also had told many of the social media agencies that the influencers were coming got housing for free.
Stop. Are you serious?
Mm-hmm. So let's take stock. It's 45 days from the event. They have nowhere for anyone to sleep. There are no villas. They have FEMA tents. And it's just basically this concrete slab leading to bluffs that lead to the ocean that you can't really swim in.
What a nightmare.
What a nightmare.
And people are paying so much money for this.
Into the story comes a man named Kevin Wells, a financier who had been looking at Magnesis Company for a little while. And I'll be so real, the way that he comes off in the documentary is more of like, well, I couldn't do any of this stuff that he's doing, so there's no way that he's doing this. Like, this seems sketchy.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, it was very arrogant. So he's been looking into Magnesis when he sees the video for Firefest and some of the bands that were listed. And some of those bands listed, Wells said in the Netflix and Hulu documentary, are, quote, some bands that I work with, so I called the agents and asked about the situation, end quote. The agents essentially responded with, like, this doesn't make any sense, and also we haven't gotten paid.
Oh.
Which made Calvin want to dive even further. From here, he took the published map of the festival layout from the website and finds that they have actually rented an area just north of the Sandals Resort and drew the map in such a way that it made it look like it was on a deserted island.
What?
It's also important to note that in this area, there are no buildings, there is no electricity or running water. Where are people going to poop?
Oh, shit. Literally.
Literally. Like, this is a really big fucking problem. Calvin creates the Twitter account Fire Fraud and starts tweeting out, and nothing fucking happens. So Calvin takes a plane down there, finds the FEMA dome tents, and how behind everything was. And I want to say that those dome tents, the ones that had been somewhat put together, because there were a couple that these local laborers did insanely impressive work in an impossible situation. Mm-hmm. Billy fucked up, but they did crazy things. Mm-hmm. The stuff that they got done was really impressive. And there is one dome where it had like some like really nice shelves and some like plants and then like nice beds with like feather down comforters. Like, they were really fucking trying. Billy just sucks so fucking much. Because at this point, we're 24 days out from the festival with 100 plus local Bohemian day laborers working 19 to 20 hour days of manual labor. And no one is getting paid.
Wow.
Employees at the time working for the fire company said that they started playing the game of, did you get paid the right amount? Because while all of this shit is happening, there's like a group of 20 to 30 people who are working on this app that they genuinely believed in and were like, thought that they would be connecting sort of like celebrities with people who want to like get them to play at their events. Like, oh, cool. If you guys can spring together however much money between your friends to get this, you know, like, I see why they thought this was very cool. Yeah. They were working very hard, but they're bleeding money at this point, because similarly to the Magnesis scam, each new bag of cash that Billy got was spent paying off the thing that had already been done and was overdue for payment. The people in the Bahamas said that he would get on a plane, go to New York, and come back with a pile of money to pay off whatever he needed. Corolla, the big investor mentioned at the beginning, was still the biggest inventor, not inventor, was still the biggest inventor at this time. And each time Billy needed money, he would turn to her. And if he couldn't get it, he would then come up with a new thing to offer on the website for the festival.
Wow.
So at one point, they needed to pay some of the day laborers. So he said, let's sell a 50K cabana online. But they didn't have a cabana to sell. They just wanted the money. Yeah. And that shit happened all the time.
Oh my God.
They would just keep offering new things that people would prepay for. And then he would use that money to pay off whatever needed to be paid off.
Wow.
There was another person running firek.com, which was like kind of the WikiLeaks of the Fyre Festival, but it didn't do anything to stop this disaster. 14 days out, and the National Guard comes and closes the job site because they aren't paying national insurance.
Oh, shit!
Once it's opened up again, by promising to pay once the festival happens, everyone is begging Billy to cancel the event, or at the very least cancel some of the people who are coming. Maybe if they brought the number of attendees down, they could make some sort of experience happen for less people. The food situation is going just about as great as the lodging situation. They had a $6 million contract with Star Foods and an allocation of $1 million in the budget to pay for it.
Wow. Wow.
There's this guy, Grant, who gets talked a lot about in both documentaries. He's sort of like Billy's Dwight. Billy is like Michael Scott. He was one who was like really pushing like all of these like fast, crazy moves also. And he is named in some of the lawsuits. But he kept being like, I wanted like sushi, chefs and fine cuisine. There's no fucking money to pay for it. So they had to cut that down to just the bare minimum of what they could.
I feel like I saw a picture where somebody got
the cheese sandwich.
Yes, it was just like bread and a slice of American cheese, right?
Yes, that does come back up because that was really the image that went the most viral as Firefest started to really crumble.
Wow.
7 days before the festival, and everyone involved other than Billy knows it's not going to come together, and they're bleeding money. They're hemorrhaging. They're dying. And it's around this time when people who are attending the festival get an email saying, quote, I notice you haven't created your Fireband account yet. This is a cashless event. The majority of our guests have added $3,000 for the weekend, but if you want to reserve tables or take part in the add-on experiences, you will want to add much more. End quote. This was Billy's newest stunt to get money and try and salvage this up-and-coming disaster.
Wow.
The first batch of attendees loaded $800,000 onto these wristbands.
Oh my God.
Now, Billy has just acquired $800,000 from these people. This idea is new to everyone involved.
Oh boy.
Behind the scenes of Fyre Festival. Because not only is this, like, where are we going to get these bands from, you know, 7 days before the festival? The Wi-Fi connectability at this area that didn't have any electricity couldn't have been tested before they even announced to the people and have taken their money. 5 days out, and the contractor is begging for more time. And no one who is supposed to be coming into this festival has heard anything about what's supposed to be happening in 5 days.
Oh my God.
In terms of online engagement, there have been no new photos of the location, and all of the original sketches of the rooms that were sold were taken off of the page.
Bad look.
Mm-hmm.
That's red flags. That's a ton of fucking red flags.
Oh, yes.
And something I feel like I should have mentioned a while before this was that Billy did not have festival insurance.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
So if the festival didn't happen, he's not getting any fucking money back.
Yeah.
The social media for the festival was getting flooded with questions, comments about logistics, and concerns. They were getting no responses back other than email concierge at fire.com. As I said in the beginning, throughout the Netflix documentary, they have a variety of talking heads, people from Jerry Media involved in that. The CEO states how quickly the questions turned to criticism and said a decision was made to screenshot the legitimate comments and questions and send them to the Fyre company, then to delete the critics and then turn off the comments altogether.
Ooh. Damn!
Oren sort of implies that that was Jerry Media's decision. Mm-hmm. But Jerry Media says that everything that they did, they were directed to do. 2 days out, and everything is basically chaos and anarchy, with people panicking about how there's no way this is going to come together. For the first time, Billy seems somewhat nervous that this might not work.
Just now, Billy? Where have you been? Asleep? What the fuck?
And he has the audacity to ask one of the laborers, do you think we can get all of this done before Thursday?
Absolutely not, you dumb motherfucker. Absolutely not.
Oh. The festival consultant, the day before, sends an email to Billy and his right-hand man, Grant, saying that this absolutely needs to be canceled. Quote, I know you're worried about blowback, but imagine if all of these people come to a remote island and have nowhere to sleep and nothing to eat. End quote.
Imagine.
Imagine. What is going to happen? However, Billy couldn't admit that canceling this was not an option, because if the festival didn't happen, he wouldn't be able to pay back any of the money he already spent. Mm-hmm. The day of the festival comes, and the morning of, starting around 3 a.m., pouring rain and thunder ensues, ruining any of the tents that had been even remotely put together.
Oh,
the ones that weren't put together had their mattresses sitting outside in a pile, getting poured on.
Wow. Every single step of the way, this just gets worse and worse and worse.
It really does. It really, really does. While all of this is happening, guests are boarding their planes to pull up to the, quote, private jet experience. They were all promised to fly into the Bahamas. They're met with just a literally shitty 737. Right before people get onto the second plane, Blink-182 announces that they're pulling out because they, quote, don't believe they have what they need to give people the performance they deserve, end quote. And more red flags get ignored by attendees.
That was their PR fancy social media way of saying, we're getting the fuck out of here because this shit is not going well.
No. And I do kind of wish they said more. If they knew something, I wish they had said more.
Yeah.
Because of all of the rain, they close the campsite and bus people over to a restaurant who was not expecting around 500 people to show up, but were able to make it work. Firefest forced everyone to stay there for about 6 hours, while the campsite was a complete fucking disaster. The restaurant owner was being bombarded with questions about a festival that she had nothing to do with, other than feeding the people who were trying to build it up. Afterwards, they're put, again, back on just shitty school buses and bused to the site. They're brought to basically a gravel parking lot covered in sand that was filled with old FEMA tents. Now, according to the Hulu documentary, there was one influencer and like a group of her friends that did get a villa. Mm-hmm. So good for them, I guess.
Good for that one group.
Yeah, seriously. People began collecting in front of the one house that was sort of the headquarters that Billy had been operating out of, waiting for hours to have their questions answered. Eventually, Billy himself came out and stood up on a table and answered questions one by one. When someone asked where people who booked the villa experience go, he responded with, "There are no villas. Anyone who booked one, go get a tent." And suddenly, the tents became a free-for-all experience.
Wow. I can just imagine people running.
Yeah. Right?
Jesus.
It's not good. And we're talking about, like, social media influencers who came to this experience ready to document everything. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of footage from the attendees of this time period.
Well, I need to watch the Hulu documentary.
Yeah, it is so, so fascinating. My next line. Now, let's remember the large group of somewhat entitled influencers and elite that went to this festival that cost thousands of dollars. Which is how we get this quote from one of the attendees who was included in the Netflix documentary. Quote, "We didn't want neighbors, so eventually we started ransacking other tents, poking holes," like, and he did the cutting motion, "in tents to make them useless and flipping mattresses." He then starts laughing as he says, "My buddy pissed on a few of the beds," end quote.
Oh my God.
There already aren't enough tents for the 500 people, only the 500 people, the one third, like nothing compared to what's supposed to show up. And these assholes decide to go ahead and make it worse.
Wow. When you have so much money that you just have no consequences to your actions and you think you can do whatever you want. And destroying someone's shelter is what you choose to do.
Because you don't want neighbors?
Like, go fuck yourself.
Right? Isn't that so fucking foul?
Mm-hmm.
So someone in the documentary said there was a definite turning point. When the sun went down, so did the camaraderie.
Oh, God. Like I said at the beginning of this, not a safe place, not a place I would want to be.
Nope. It wasn't until 9 p.m. that two 18-wheeler shipping containers came with everyone's luggage. But there was no organized way of passing it out. So they were basically just calling names and people were like running up and trying to get their shit. There were also no lights there. There's no electricity.
Oh my God.
So at nighttime, everyone was scattered across this construction site, which again is a housing development that's surrounded on multiple sides by bluffs with huge drops to the ocean and no fucking fence. There's this one talking head on the Hulu documentary named Seth, and he's definitely like a rich guy, but he had this Twitter account that's sort of like a joke parody account about the, quote, most influential influencer ever, and that parody name is William Needham Finley IV. And he just like constantly like going like, at Ray-Bans, I accidentally stepped on my sunglasses with my brand new at Yeezy sneakers. Please send me some. I'm an influencer. Like, he posts some really funny shit, but then at the same time, like, you still had enough money to go to Fyre Festival. Don't pretend like you're not one of these people, mm-hmm. bro. Just feel like I need to call him out a little bit. Seth started tweeting out pictures from the festival of the campgrounds, and the tweet started going viral. However, the most infamous tweet from this disaster, fiasco, was the photo of the cheese sandwich. Mick from Jerry Media said, quote, "What a lot of news cycles missed was that this entire hype was built by an orange tile posted on social media by the most important influencers in the world. And it was taken down by a picture of a cheese sandwich posted by someone with 400 followers."
Another orange square. The cheese.
The cheese.
It began with an orange square and it ended with an orange square.
Oh my God, I fucking love that. I will be so honest. I was one of those people on Twitter watching gleefully as all of this burned and truly loving it. Watching this unfold, I am like, was like such schadenfreude. Like, I was like, yes. Oh no, you guys spent $250,000 to get to this private island and it's not gonna work out. Like, boo fucking who.
Woe is me.
Right? Lifestyles of the rich and famous. Like, fuck you. At this point, the music acts have not yet been canceled, but by the next morning, the talent coordinator canceled them all. Billy went from thinking he was the greatest entrepreneur of our decade to being a complete fucking joke. Right? People were just trying to leave the island at this point, and they completely overwhelmed the airport. The first flight back to Miami boarded at 1:30 a.m. on April 28th, but it was delayed for hours due to issues with the flight's manifest not adding up with the number of people on board.
Uh-oh.
They had 111 people on the manifest and 112 people on board. Once they got that figured out, it was canceled again because the pilot and attendants who had been hired to work for that had been now working for too long and they needed to get a new crew.
Ugh.
These drugged passengers were locked in the Exuma airport terminal. And they said that they did this because they couldn't have someone going on to, like, the airplane side and lighting up a cigarette and, like, having shit explode because airport fuel, like, is so fucking flammable. Mm-hmm. But they were also locked in the airport terminal with no access to food, water, or air conditioning.
Whoa.
And they had all just been drinking, like, they had all just had tequila poured down their throats for 6 hours and then went to this fucking, basically, FEMA disaster site. It was so hot in there that one person passed out from the heat and had to be hospitalized. Shit. No one who had helped create any of the infrastructure of what existed for the last month and a half had been paid, and they wanted to be.
The best.
They were. And they wanted the minimum tens of thousands of dollars that was owed to them. And Billy was nowhere to be seen. Delroy went to his house. Delroy Jackson, a bartender that I talked about in the beginning who was involved, went to his house and the whole thing was literally cleaned out. The other people involved in the music festival started bailing, leaving the locals like Delroy to deal with the fallout. Day after day, Delroy and the others were being harassed and Billy would simply respond with, "I'll handle it later." Eventually, Delroy and some others had to leave the island because it was too much harassment for them to handle. Now, again, this festival was supposed to be linked to the app Fyre, and this festival ruined all of the work that that team had been working on.
I didn't even know that an app was supposed to be a thing until you said it.
Same. This was the first I'd ever heard of it. A majority of those people who were on that team weren't involved in the festival in any way whatsoever. Ja Rule posted a note on Twitter saying, quote, "I wanted this to be an amazing event. It was not a scam as everyone is reporting. I don't know how everything went so left, but I'm working to make it right by making sure everyone is refunded." He went on to say, "I truly apologize. This is not my fault, but I'm taking responsibility."
He's really gonna tell us that he didn't know shit?
In the Hulu documentary at one point, they straight up ask Billy, like, did Ja know that this was bad? And Billy just said, like, "I am not going to talk about our private conversations." But Ja Rule has escaped quite a bit of legal trouble from this.
Yeah.
And actually, for a little while, tried to launch an app very similar to Fyre. And I went and tried to find that app today, and they haven't launched that one yet, but they have, like, something kind of tangentially related to it, about, like, live streaming musical performances and shit.
Okay.
So I was like, that's interesting. I wonder if they pivoted because of COVID.
Okay. Yeah, maybe.
As the attendee Seth was leaving, he tweeted out, "Goodbye, Firefest. You'll be hearing from Stacey Miller," who is his lawyer. Like, he has a fucking lawyer. Get out of here, bro. You're not some, like, poor, not you're an influencer. There was a $100 million class action lawsuit filed, but Seth and his friend decided to file separately. McFarland and Ja Rule were the subject of a $100 million lawsuit in the state of California, but Ja Rule was later dismissed from the lawsuit by a judge in July of 2019. It was filed on behalf of plaintiff Daniel Jung by entertainment lawyer Mark Garagos, who is seeking class action status for the lawsuit with more than 150 plaintiffs.
Ooh.
I will get into what happened with that lawsuit in a little bit. Part of the lawsuit was also targeted to the influencers who advertised all of Fyre Festival without saying that it was an advertisement, something that has been a huge source of discussion in the recent years, but actually really started with Fyre Festival, which I had no idea.
Yeah.
Billy McFarland told the 20 to 30 employees of the Fyre app that, quote, "No one is getting fired, but there will be no payroll for a while and no official employment," essentially forcing his employees to quit, with many of them voicing concerns that they then wouldn't be able to file for unemployment benefits.
Yo, fuck this guy.
Isn't he just Continuously the worst?
Yes.
Right? The FBI then started going around and speaking with everyone they could who was involved in the festival. Oh, shit. However, none of the people who were involved had quite put together the depths of everything that Billy had done. Billy was defrauding investors by overvaluing the Fire app. For example, they told them they were booking high-level celebrities such as Drake for low prices such as $100,000, which never happened, but it made it seem like they were about to be making a lot of money.
Wow.
The original offer report had the company listed as bringing in $1.5 million, but the doctored report from Billy quoted it as $34.79
million. What? Oh my God.
Like, that is like the very definition of fraud. Billy also claimed that he had $2 million in Facebook stock when he had about 1,500.
That is quite a difference.
So, yeah. Some of the millions that Billy racked up on the Fire Company card was to pay off the tickets that he had purchased for the Magnesis card users. Stop. That's how far back this fraud shit goes.
Oh my God.
He didn't pay off $250,000 of that, which someone else from the Magnesis company is being sued for by Amex.
Oh shit.
Billy also left at least $150,000 in outstanding bills on his employees' personal Amex cards for the festival, all saying that they would be paid back.
Oh God.
$250,000 was owed to the construction workers local to the Bahamas who helped build everything up.
Oh.
The restaurant owner, who fed all of the attendees for 6 hours, and all of the food, like, fed all of the workers for the festival food, went through $50,000 of her savings to cover the costs of the extra employee wages and food given out to the workers of the Fire Festival.
Oh my God.
Billy was arrested, but released on a $300,000 bail while awaiting trial. Oh, come on.
Really? That guy's bail should have been way higher.
So much higher. And while he was on bail, he was living large in a penthouse at a hotel.
Wow, I hate him.
While this is happening, NYC VIP Frank Tribble starts emailing people who attended Firefest offering access to exclusive events, including Taylor Swift meet and greets, the Victoria's Secret fashion show, and the Met Gala. Seth Krasno in the Hulu documentary starts talking about these emails with other attendees from the Firefest and learned that they were all getting them. In the Hulu documentary, on camera, he says, quote, "I assumed Billy had sold the email list or something." And that's when the person asking him questions from off camera lets him know that Frank was actually just the hired face and voice of NYC VIP Access, so that Billy didn't get recognized as the person who was really behind it. Billy would feed Frank a script of what to tell people on the phone, because you cannot buy tickets to the Victoria's Secret fashion show or the Met Gala. Those are both invite only. And everyone who attends the Met Gala has to be personally pre-approved by Anna Wintour. Like, you cannot. Impossible. Well, out on bail for fraud, Billy is literally doing more fraud, where 15 people gave him over $100,000 for these tickets to events he'd never be able to purchase.
Wow.
The day after Vice writer, journalist writes an article about these things, Billy is arrested again, charged, and sentenced to 6 years.
It should be so much more.
Not enough. Jerry Media provided a statement that explained their actions. All actions taken by Jerry Media were done at the direction of Fire Festival. While problems with the festival seem obvious in retrospect, Jerry Media was never privy to any information about the production of the event on island. We arrived on island for the first time 24 hours before the festival was set to begin. Instead, Grant Margolin, who managed marketing relationships, was providing us with assurances that everything was according to plan. In short, like the ticket holders, contractors, investors, and Bohemians who were misled by the Fyre Festival leadership, we were also misled by the Fyre Festival leadership who hid the realities. So they skirted blame. Billy served less than 4 years and ended up getting out of jail last year, March of 2022.
Wow. Not enough. And what about, what happened? Does he still owe all of these people money? All these people still need money from him?
The large class action lawsuit was originally going to give attendees involved 7,200 damages. However, the Fyre Festival ticket holders saw their class action payout slashed to just $280 each in bankruptcy court.
What?
Billy declared bankruptcy.
Wow. $280?
So that's from 2021.
Okay.
Before that happened, July 3rd, 2018, the two North Carolina attendees, Seth Crosno and Mark Thompson, were awarded $5 million each in damages. The judgment was granted against Billy in absentia after he failed to respond to the court proceedings. Ja Rule was initially named as a co-defendant, but was later removed from the suit after an undisclosed private agreement with the two attendees' attorney.
Oh.
So they got their money, but a lot of the people in the Bahamas didn't. Ugh. Like the other Bohemian suppliers, the caterer who worked at the event was not paid. In a 2019 crowdfunding appeal, raised over $200,000 to compensate her. In 2020, the United States Marshals Service auctioned off Fyre Festival branded merchandise that McFarland had kept for future sales, with proceeds to go to the victims.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And that is the story of Fyre Festival.
What a bunch of fuckery.
Right? It's so much more than I thought it was. Mm-hmm. How was this an hour and a half? Holy shit.
Yeah. We're literally at an hour and 29 minutes.
Dude, damn.
That shit went deep.
Yeah. Dude, this shit blew my mind. Blew my fucking mind.
It was fraudception.
Yeah. Needless to say, if anyone has any Fyre Festival merch, I'm willing to buy it off of you. I want a hat so fucking bad. So fucking bad.
Oh, you are so funny, Katie.
Yeah, and that's this week's episode. I hope y'all enjoyed it.
Yes. And we'll see you next week.
Bye. Bye. For any photos related to today's episode, please go to our Instagram.
You can follow us on Instagram and TikTok at AL2KPodcast.
Like us on Facebook at Always the Last to Know Podcast.
If you have any questions, please email us at AL2KPodcast@gmail.com.
Please share, rate, and review us on your podcast listening app of choice.
Join our Patreon. You can find us at patreon.com/AL2KPodcast or click the link in our bio on social media.
Thanks for listening.